All right, today is February 10th, 2014. As I said in the last interview, this is either the second or the fourth interview with Jerry Apps, depending how you want to look at it. This is the second one I'm doing with him. He did two others prior to these interviews. We are here at his home in Madison, and my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Mass Oral History Program. So we left off last time. You talked, given us quite a few good anecdotes about your memories of the student protest era. And as we left that discussion and shut down for the day, you said that you wanted to talk about the reorganization of Extension.
Sure.
To start off with. So why don't we start off with Extension?
Yeah. In fact, just so that you have it down, I have one of my books is called The People Came First, A History of Wisconsin Cooperative Extension, which was published by UW Extension in 2002. And it includes an extensive discussion of the organization, the reorganization of Extension, and what it meant, especially what it meant to Cooperative Extension and the College of Ag and Life Sciences. Mm-hmm. And as I explain in this book, when Fred Harvey Harrington became president of the university, which was in 1962, and I got to know Fred Harrington very well. He was a historian, and he also was a very, very liberal. I'm sure he was a Democrat, but we didn't talk about that. But he was very intrigued with cooperative extension and how Cooperative Extension was able to reach out into the communities, in that there were extension agents in every county with programs for, in those days, primarily for rural people. And Harrington was very much interested in using the Cooperative Extension model in urban areas, because that was the time that Lyndon Johnson's programs were being passed and discussed, and he thought that he would be able to get some additional federal money to use if he were somehow to reorganize all of Extension using some of the Cooperative Extension experience as a model. And I don't know if Harrington was not aware, probably not, of how strongly the College of Agriculture felt about Cooperative Extension. Because Cooperative Extension formally began in 1914, 100 years ago now, with the passage of the Smith-Lever Act. But the first county agent in Wisconsin was hired 2 years prior to that, 1912, in Oneida County. So Wisconsin's College of Agriculture and Co-op Extension had a long, long history, and a remarkably successful one, with a lot of people being very, quite pleased with what Cooperative Extension was doing. Well, Harrington put together a planning committee, or a committee to look at the possibility of doing that, and he somehow, I don't know if he wasn't aware, and I was in graduate school and during part of that time, of what was going on politically, but he got, and this is kind of an interesting aside, Gilbert Rohde from Chippewa Falls area was at that time on the Board of Regents, and he was also the head of the National of the Farmers Union. And the Farmers Union, some of the Farmers Union members were a little concerned that Cooperative Extension by the middle 60s was spending more time with large-scale farmers than with smaller farmers, the small family farm. Because, and I could go at length, and I've written about this, there was a tremendous transition going on in agriculture during that time, starting in about 1945, 6, and on up through the 60s. Tremendous turmoil and change in agriculture generally. Well, Rohde was not all that pleased with, at least in his mind, Cooperative Extension ought to have been doing more, in his mind, with the small family farmer. So he was one that supported Harrington. much to the consternation of the ag school people. And to this day, if you've talked to some of the old timers, and I belong to an old timers professor group, they have no love for the reorganization of extension. Well, what this now is in 60, let's see, the regents approved, I'm checking this from my book, the regents approved Harrington's merger proposal on September 6, 1963. And at that time, Rudolf Frocker was dean of the College of Ag. He was an ag economist, but he was ill. And he stepped down as dean, and Glenn Pound took over. You probably know all of this, a plant pathologist. And Pound took over in September 1, 1964. And when he took over, he asked Harrington, well, would there be a chance that we could overturn that decision? Because Pound was a staunch believer that the cooperative extension should be in the College of Agriculture and should remain there. It all had been there, it should continue to be there. Every other state in the nation at that time, I believe this is true, every other state, the co-op extension was in the College of Ag. So this would have been, was a major shift in how cooperative extension was organized. And Pound was, I knew him very well. He was not one to embrace, he was not one to have some of the power, budgetary power, rested away from him, to put it very bluntly. And that's true of most administrators. They don't want anybody tampering with their budgets. And this is my judgment as I looked at the whole thing and studied it and lived through it. Pound, I believe, did not think this would ever make it. He thought there would be enough opposition on the part of farmers, communities, and especially the rank-and-file professor in the College of Ag. He just thought it was never going to make it. And of course, he was wrong. The merger involved a cooperative extension, general extension, and radio television, plus the survey, whatever it's called, a smaller unit. Mm-hmm. Most people don't even know that. Mm-hmm. That was part of it. Mm-hmm. And general extension had an entirely different model of organization and culture. Cooperative extension, again, had field-based people. I happen to have been one of them in all the counties. General extensions, people were essentially based here in Madison, although there were some connections with the two-year campuses of Green Bay and Baraboo and Richland Center and all over the state. So here now we have two entirely different models. Plus add to that radio television. And radio television, well, they just want to do it. They didn't know anything. Oh, I should be that blunt. But they, as far as cooperative extension was concerned, that was just something that was out there. They knew about it. It was a good thing, but they were neither for nor against it. They were just there. So all of this outfit is coming together. Everybody assumed that Hank Algren, who was Henry Algren, who was the associate dean of the College of Agriculture at that time, and also the director of cooperative extension in the College of Ag. He's an agronomy professor. He was one of my teachers at one time. Hank Algren, they thought, would surely be the new chancellor of this big new organization. And he Harrington chose not to appoint him for a lot of interesting reasons, because he did not want this new organization with three or four different cultures coming together to feel that he was leaning toward ag and co-op extension, because co-op extension was largely agricultural home economics and 4-H at that time, still is. And so he appointed a history professor, of all things, to head up the cooperative extension. And he was just Donald McNeil, I knew him very well, very nice guy. But he was, and this is, well, when you get my age, you don't care what you say sometimes. I think he was way over his head in understanding what it was that he was facing. Because here we've got general extension people who, in a sense, aren't even a part of the they were not a part of the Madison campus. They were sitting off there by themselves. And general extension itself has a long, really interesting history that's just, well, it's what it is. And co-op extension was always integral to the campus. In fact, all of the co-op extension people, we all had joint appointments or full appointments. We're all in the College of A. We all had professorial appointments. And so they're very, very different culture. And all these folks are coming together. And I tell you, it was a tough goal for those first few years, because they kind of looked at each other. What? Who are you? And why are you here? And you're in general extension because you couldn't pass muster on the Madison campus and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting time. So how was I involved with all of that? Well, in 1966, when all of this was now coming together, I was in graduate school, finishing my PhD. And in those days, maybe it's still true. At least it's recommended. I could not do my graduate work in the College of A, so I did it in CNI, in the School of Education. And I was looking in on all of this stuff, and now to show the relationship to our department, because it was very much involved with all of this. Now, to go back, my department originally was called, and I have another book coming out on the history of Wisconsin agriculture that the Historical Society is publishing. And in there I have the history of all the departments, mm-hmm. how they got started and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, our department originally, my department was called the Department of Agricultural Education, and it was organized in 1907. It's one of the oldest departments, And it was organized for the purpose of preparing teachers of agriculture for high schools, and for the county agricultural schools, of which there were a few, and for the normal schools, were the two-year normal school programs for country school teachers. And J.A. James was the first head of the department and the only member of the department. Isn't that interesting? And then back in 1907. And I happened to know him. He was still around when I was doing my undergraduate work, because I did my undergraduate major in that department. Walter Brocker, B-J-O-R-A-K-E-R, Walt Brocker from Owatonna, Minnesota, PhD from University of Minnesota, came in after James. Well, as the years went along, and when Henry Algren now being a professor of agronomy and became director of extension, one of the first things that Henry faced was the disparity in salaries between the county extension people, co-op extension people, and those on the Madison campus. And there was a great disparity. And there were some reasons for it, one of which was the majority of the Madison campus professors had PhD degrees, doctorates, and the majority of the cooperative extension people, most of them had bachelor's degrees. That was it. And so the argument was clearly from the graduate school, from the president's office, well, we can't do anything for you. Hank, you've got a group of people that do not have the educational qualifications, and there will not be, nobody's going to approve that. So what Hank did, it was very interesting. He came to Walt Brocker, and he said to Walt, and I was working across the hall as a publications editor at the time, and Walt had been my major professor in my undergraduate program. And Hank came to Walt and said, we need to change the name of your department and broaden the responsibility of the department to include two major activities, both of which involve extension people. Hank is talking, I want the department to assume the responsibility of the staff development for all of the cooperative extension people. meaning helping them with program planning, with evaluation strategies, with teaching approaches. Television was just beginning to come in then, how to do that, how to improve your radio work, everything like that. Our department, he wanted our department to take on the responsibility of organizing those staff development activities. So he brought in, Walt brought in, with Henry's help to find budget, Patrick Boyle, Jim Duncan, and then later me, and our responsibilities were now twofold, and I mentioned the second part of it. We were to serve as instructors and major professors for those cooperative extension people who were coming back to school to get a master's degree that would allow them to be competitive for salary. It was kind of an ingenious thing. And to do that, of course, these people were older and married, and how can they just lift up their families and come to Madison? So Hank found somewhere, I don't know where, money to provide assistantships to these people. And most of these were research assistantships. And can you imagine, when I started in the department in 1964, I still had a master's degree. And I had, I think, a half a dozen research assistants working for me. Never did I have it so good in all the rest of my career. And I, in fact, I had more research assistants than I had to do with, because I was trying to do my own graduate work. Well, that, so we now with, and Pat and was Pat Boyle was sort of heading all of this up. And J. Mitchell Mackey was also a part of that. He was the personnel director for Co-op Extension at that time. Now, we're all in the College of Ag. That's the important thing to note. Well, with this reorganization, everything was tossed into the hat. And I finished my doctorate in 66 and went back to work in 67. And now, all of a sudden, I discovered that my program and staff development activities are now in University of Wisconsin Extension, because a new division called, I think it was called that, Program and Staff Development, was organized, and Pat Boyle was the director, and soon I'm the associate director. With a 75% appointment in Extension and a 25% appointment back in the department. Now, the clumsy part of that was we had to maintain two offices. I had an office in Ag Hall, second floor, and I had an office in the Extension building on Lake Street. And so I spent half my life walking back and forth from one office to the other. Can you imagine that today? They can't even find one office for a professor sometimes. But here we all had two offices running back and forth. Well, in the middle of all of this, Pound is just furious, because all that money, that 75%, that had been in the College of Ag budget, now is in this new, it's never going to work, according to Pound, organization called University of Wisconsin Extension. Well, I think they were a little over-exuberant in their organization, because there were deans in every direction. There was a dean of economic development and a dean of outreach, and if you look in, I've got all of that in here, they were over-deaned, to say the least. And then Pat Boyle, I think it was in 67 or 8, he decided to bugger off to Ireland. He's Irish in background, and he had an opportunity to go there and teach for a year. So now I'm the acting director of Program and Staff Development. And did I learn? I tell you, it was absolutely... The meetings that we had, and we had a lot of them, were something else, with all of these deans and trying to understand each other and get to know each other and appreciate each other's programs. It was just a fascinating time. I had always been, still am, of course, interested in writing. So the deans in those days, I suppose they still have to do that, had to come up with elaborate budget narratives. And so guess who wrote the elaborate budget narratives? it was awful. I mean, these guys, these dudes, I got to know, really, bringing a whole pile of stuff, and here, make something out of this. See if you can make sense out of it. See if you can write a narrative that will get us some money. So it was kind of an interesting time.
But that wasn't part of, I mean, that was something you were doing as a part of your job, but it wasn't specifically a part of your job.
There was, I had, in the years that I worked in Extension, I don't think there was ever a job description put in front of me. Jerry, this is what we want you to do.
So 3/4 of your time was in Extension, but
at that point
it could have been any...
Yeah, it was everything from conducting workshops in Hayward helping people with using technology to writing budget proposals. I was doing all of that kind of stuff.
So then when you came back, what was your 25%?
Well, my 25% was teaching and research. And I was teaching, two courses. I taught a course called Introduction to Extension. And that whole idea was for undergraduates who were interested in a career in cooperative extension. That's one of the courses that they took. Mm-hmm. And I also developed a course called the Analysis and Development of an Adult Education Philosophy. And I don't look like a philosopher, do I? But I taught that philosophy course for probably 20 years and continue to do that in my career after someone else took over the extension part. Now, I can go back and tell you a little bit about how the department then reacted to all of this stuff.
Right.
The reorganization of extension now is in the middle 60s. You've got to put that in the context of what I was talking about last time too. This campus was in just crazy wild. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had riots every night, marches, tear gas flying, and we're trying to do this reorganization. I mean, it was something else when you think back at it.
And there was internal discussion too about DDT at that point too, right? You sort of alluded to that last time about the DDT wars within the college.
Sure, all of this was coming together, and I just thought it was fascinating. I mean, I don't know why, but I just thought it was really interesting because there's never a dull moment. You never knew what was going to happen, and I at the time I thought that was sort of interesting and fun, Well, I think I mentioned the entomologist who drank DDT every day to prove that there was anything wrong with it. I don't think they had to embalm him. I don't know. It ends up in your liver. So all of that was going on. And then the department, and let me just trace that through now. Remember, since it started in 1907, one of the oldest departments. And then it was reorganized into Agricultural and Extension Education. And that must have been in about 19, I don't know the exact year, 55 maybe, something like that, 56. That's about it. Because 56 I came back to do my master's degree, mm-hmm. From the Army. And I forgot to mention Jim Duncan. Jim, they brought Jim in to help with the extension work as well. Okay. So Jim, Pat Boyle, and then later myself. But I was doing my master's in 56, and at that time it was Ag and Extension Education. When I finished my tour in the counties, I spent 5 years out in the counties, and then a couple of years as a publications editor, in 64 I came full-time into the department when Jim Duncan went on leave to teach in Brazil, because College of Ag had a contract with Brazil to establish a new ag college there. And we also had a contract, College of Ag had a contract with Nigeria, with two major international efforts going on. So Jim was off to Brazil, and then I took his place. He stayed on an extra year, so it'd be 64, 65, 66. Yeah, he was there. So by the time he got back, they already hired me as an additional person in the department. So I started in the department in 64, and that's when the discussions began taking place about the reorganization of the department itself. And that was, interesting enough, it took 10 years of discussion for a new department to emerge. The players involved were in three schools. The College of Agriculture, which was called in those days, and Family Resources and Consumer Sciences, the Home Ec School, and the School of Education. In Fracas, we called the Family Resources and Consumer Sciences, there was a department of Home Ec Extension and Education. And so the idea was, well, that department should merge with our department. So that was one merger. Then in the School of Education, in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction, there was an adult education unit, which included Robert Boyd, Bert Kreitlow, I guess those two primarily. Oh, Wilson Thede, those three. And then there was also in Educational Policy Studies, Bert Kreitlow had a joint appointment in Ed Policy Studies as well. Also in CNI, there were some vocational units. There was a program in business education. Merle Strong headed that up. So the idea was to put together all of the vocational stuff and all the extension stuff into one department. And again, we met literally for 10 years in order to figure out how in the world we were going to do that. One of the contentious issues was, interestingly enough, what to call the thing. And we eventually called it Continuing and Vocational Education. And those interested in adult education, they were not happy because we weren't using that language. And vocational education, the idea of vocational education, by that time, there was a fairly large contingent on campus. I was on the Social Studies Divisional Committee at that time that just thought there should be no vocational education on this campus at all. That's, I'm sure you've run into this, but there's a great ranking of the importance of departments, and vocational education was right down there with physical education. I mean, it was, who would want to be associated with that? That didn't help our cause. But anyway, we got this department together, and now we've got different cultures again. My goodness. The School of Education's culture is not the College of Ag's. Here we've got all this co-op extension ag stuff in our culture. School of Education, they didn't know about that. And Home Ec, well, they sort of knew about that, but not really. Mm-hmm. So we all came together in 1974. A bunch of us, my gosh, I think there were probably 20 of us. It was a fairly substantial group. And we had almost immediately, we had like 100 undergraduate students and that many graduate students. I mean, it was a big department compared to what it had been. And where should we have an office? Oh, my gosh. And again, well, should it be an Ag Hall? Well, yeah, it's got to be an Ag Hall. Pounds anyway. Well, this is, again, I'm going to lose control again. If this outfit moves over to the School of Education, well, we moved. I think it was a mistake. We moved over to the teacher education building on Mill Street for our main office, for head office. That was only for the chair, though, because of I still had a joint appointment with the College of Ag. And one of the interesting dimensions of it all is that it was organized, but the money stayed where it was. That was the compromise. Meaning, if you were in the School of Education, that school kept your budget, and that's where you had your tenure. Although we had quote-unquote courtesy appointments in the other two schools. I guess the School of Education still thinks I have an appointment there because I hear from their retired people every so often. The Home Ec School, I think they've forgotten about me. I don't hear from them anymore. So I maintained all along. My budget stayed in the... Well, the part that wasn't an extension, it was staying in the 25%. Well, then this was 74 and 75, and in the department, we started doing some interesting things, which got us into trouble. One of the things that we put together was a week, can you imagine how this would sound radical today? We put together a weekend master's degree program. Unheard of. A graduate school thought this would never fly, should not fly, and lack the quality that was associated with graduate work. And that became, people would come Friday night, we'd have classes Friday night, all day Saturday, and I think we turned them loose Saturday night, something like that. And we did that every other week, maybe, all semester. The same number of hours. The contact hours were exactly the same. We had to retrain our own faculty, most of whom were 50-minute people, to realize that, what are you going to do all day, for God's sake? You can't stand there and talk to people all day. They'll all fall asleep, and so will you. So we, those of us with co-op extension backgrounds, we knew how to do that, because that's what we were doing with farmers all the time. So that was really interesting. The graduate school, finally, they gave approval to that. And when that was really working, the other thing we had a big argument about tuition, because we were attracting, literally, in one of my, I taught in that program, we had students from all over the country flying in on Friday for the weekend program. From New York and California, everywhere. I mean, it just sparkled. It worked very well. Well, let's see, in 1977, they wanted me to be chair. One of the interesting things, this is you've probably run into this before, but we had negative elections. You tried to convince your fellow faculty members that you were inept at administration and should have no part of it, and that you are having heart problems or some kind of, the stories, the negative stories as to why a person should not be elected as faculty person were the most creative things I ever heard. I flunked out on that and became chair. This is so backward. When you think about it, people trying to impress others so they could be elected. We're trying to impress them as to why we should not be elected. So here I am in 1979, I'm chair. Well, this gall darn organization, people forgot about the practical details of it. What it meant was, as you were chair, and in those days, every school had a departmental meetings once a month. I'm going to three of them. Just departmental meetings. School of Education, College of Ag, the Home Ec. I'll never forget this. I spent attending a meeting in a Home Ec school. We spent an hour and a half discussing who should be eligible to have a key to the building. Oh, God. It drove me nuts. I mean, well, I was not cut out to be an administrator. I hated it. So here I'm running the big old staff development unit for a year with all the staff there, and I'm down running this big department. And we had a fairly decent budget, I don't know, $1.2 million, something like that, that I had to take charge of. And of course, I was chair of the personnel committee, and we decided who got salary increases and all that stuff. I did it for 2 years, and I had it. I said, I can't do this anymore. Get somebody else to do it. I think John Thompson followed me then for a while. Because it was nearly impossible. You had no time for writing, no time for my own research. All I'm doing is running around to these stupid meetings, these very enlightening faculty gatherings to make important decisions. Let's not take that any further. Then, so 79. Well, then again in 82, then nobody wants to be chair again. So guess who becomes chair in 82? One of the things I had to do in 78, I think it was, and the university has terrible budget problems now, as you very well know, but it had terrible problems then too. And I think it was 1977, I had a 12-month appointment, and we had to either cut faculty or change our appointment time. So I fired myself and hired me back at 9 months. And I wanted the bunch of the faculty to do that. None of them would do it. I think one more person did it. And it was sort of goofy because the summer school budget is a different budget. So I hired myself back at 9 months, put myself on the summer school budget. I'd make more money than I was on the 12-month, but that's another story. Enough of that foolishness in 79. So back in 82 now, I'm back at it again. And of course, when I went 9 months, I had to resign from Co-op Extension because they didn't have any 9-month people. You had to be 12 months. So that was a big decision. Because now I had federal retirement. I was a federal civil service person. That's all extension people, Co-op Extension people were in those days. So I quit Extension, and now in 82 I came back in Extension. Part of the deal was if you want me to be, and these were the deans saying, geez, well, you got to do this. Everybody else don't want to. I don't want to do it either. Well, you should do it. So I'm doing it. But I arranged to get a halftime appointment in an extension again. So I got back on federal retirement. That was one of the little gifts. So I forgot to mention along the way I was editing the Journal of Extension and all that kind of stuff. So now in 82, 83, I did it for 5 years, 87, 82 to 87. And those were really good years. I was teaching a couple of courses.
So not as many meetings, or you were just used to it, or?
Well, I knew which ones I could skip and which ones I needed to go to, and the department had now enough experience. Back in 77, we were just too young, too new to know what the heck to do, so we had to figure it out. There were still a lot of meetings, but it was working better, and at that time we were recognized as the top adult education department in the country, which is ironic because not many years later we were eliminated. Well, in 87, Leo Walsh was dean of the College of Ag and Life Sciences. And Leo said, Jerry, I want you to work on writing the I think that was the celebration of 100 years, I think that's right, of College of Ag. I want you to write, we're doing a long range plan, I want you to write it. And here's a committee that you will work with. And so you can work out of my office. And then that gave me a really good excuse to resign by chairing the department. And then I worked out of Leo's office writing this long report that nobody ever looked at. But don't, which is so true of so many of those. Well, then in 1989, and now I'm not those years. Well, let's go back. 87, must be 87, I must have resigned Extension. When I left the department, I must have resigned Extension again. That's true. And Pat Boyle was always ticked off with me because I was in and out of Extension all the time and he wanted me to stay in Extension. But Pat gets in touch with me, and it must have been 89, and said, I'm working with Pat Borich, B-O-R-I-C-H, who is the head of Co-op Extension for the University for Minnesota. And I'm working with Ed Boone, B-O-O-N-E, Edward Boone, from North Carolina State University. He had been a graduate, PhD graduate of our department, to put together a proposal to the Kellogg Foundation for a leadership training program for extension and deans and directors and vice presidents and such as that. And he said, I want you to help us put together this proposal. And it was I must apologize. I looked for the document. I've got it here someplace and I can't find it. I don't remember the numbers. It's like $2.5 million or $4.5 million. It's a bunch of money. I don't know the exact number. It's somewhere. So we put together this proposal, and flew over to Battle Creek and met with the people there. And it's a big old system that you work through. And waited, and pretty soon we discovered, by golly, we're going to get this thing funded. And Pat and the two Pats and Ed Boone said, well, now we want you, me, to be the director of this thing. And that was one of the most interesting things that I've ever done. I started doing that in 1989. It was called the National Extension Leadership Development Program. And it had several facets to it. One of the facets was the training of people who wanted to advance from lower level administrative positions to higher level administrative positions. It's almost ironic that somebody who detests administration should be preparing people for roles in administration. But my PhD was in leadership development, so I knew something about this stuff. And we put this thing together, got the money, and then we had to figure out the curriculum. And I said, when I accepted it, I said, look, and I'm far enough along in my career now where I don't care. I said, look, I'll do this, but I've got to have something to say about the curriculum. It's not going to be sit in the classroom and have somebody lecture on leadership theory. We're not going to do that. And if that's what you want, then you go find somebody else. They said, well, we don't see what you can. Tell us what you'd like to do. So I put together a little planning committee. And we developed an experiential leadership training program that I still feel very happy about. I've written a whole book about it. You can read the theory behind it, because there is a lot of theory behind it. But it was a very practical thing. Some examples. We put together classes of these folks. They all had to have a PhD degree before they could get into it. So there wasn't any degree stuff involved. There wasn't any credit involved. And we put together the first class in 89, I think at 15 or 20. And then in the next couple of, we had three classes that were funded. And we were supposed to be the model so the other states could pick this up later, which happened. 30, I think, were in the other two classes. To give you an example of some of what we did, and mind you, these people were all working full-time. Some were chairs, departmental chairs, some were assistant deans, that sort of stuff. And they're from all over the United States. One of the wrinkles in the program was that we would also have, I think, 15%, 10%, 20% of the group had to be from outside of the university. They had to be from the private sector. So we had AT&T people, we had a whole bunch of different organizations, big company, Motorola. We had Motorola person, which was kind of fun, because we wanted these folks, the leadership group, to become acquainted with, intimately acquainted with, living with people who had quite a different perspective. So that was one of the things we did. And then we had workshops, several of them during the year, I think four, maybe something like that. And one of the workshops, back to my philosophy of education, every person had to develop a philosophy of leadership, written, thought through, presented. Here's an example of one of the things we did. I wanted them, these are some of the goals. I wanted them to become acquainted not only with up-to-date leadership strategies, but I wanted them to become acquainted with the civil rights movement, with Native Americans, with African Americans, with all of that sort of thing. And so one group I took to, we went to Bismarck, we went to the Garrison Dam in North Dakota, on the Missouri River, and we lived a week with the Mandan Indian tribe. And then I hired a Mandan shaman to travel with us, and we canoed from the Garrison Dam to Bismarck, North Dakota, on the Missouri River, camping at the Lewis and Clark campsites Lewis and Clark had come up to Missouri to and spent the winter at, with the Mandans. And I had this shaman that I hired. I didn't tell them this, but he had a master's degree in sociology. And he also was the director of the Custer Park. One of his
The national one?
Yeah. Yeah. One of his great stories was, he says, he's a great, Mandans are tall. He's like 6'3", 250 pounds. And he's a big smile on his face. He says, I'm the only director of a national park in the country named after a loser. That's one of his favorite stories. He would all dress, he would dress up in buckskin. He spoke the language, a Mandan language, and was trying to teach the young people the language. But at every evening, he would dress up in his buckskins. And it happened to be the time of a full moon. And I'd build a big campfire on the shore. We had stayed in tents. Built, half the people, two-thirds, never been in a canoe before, side the tent. And built this big campfire. And he stood by the campfire with the full moon coming up over his shoulder, telling the discovery, the beginning stories of the Mandan tribe. Because one of my goals was to teach the group some non-linear storytelling. I didn't use that language. And he was so good at it. He was a Garrison Keillor of the First Order, starting with his story and winding it around. And here's a group of hard charging men and women who want 1, 2, 3, 4, tell me what to memorize and I'll write it down. And there's nothing to memorize because he's telling us the story. And they're all sitting there. When's he going to get to the... I can just see him. And then it comes together like that. And we did that every night. And one night, I had a car following us. I didn't tell them all this stuff. With a radio, keeping track of the weather. I was really worried about the weather. And one night, or somebody getting hurt, we had to get them out of there. Because it's very isolated. Oh my gosh, there's nothing. I am a woman from California who just thought this was the stupidest thing in the world, to be in canoes and sleeping in tents, and I'm here to learn leadership and I want to become a dean or something or another. And she comes up to me one night, first night, she says, I am not going to sleep in this tent. This is for people who like this sort of stuff, and I don't like this kind of stuff, and I'm going to stay in a motel. I said, well, fine. I got in touch with the car and said, he'll take you wherever you want to go. I did not tell her there wasn't a motel in 50 miles. And she came back and she was livid. She said, there's no motel around. That's her personal challenge. But that particular night, the next night, the storm warning was up. And severe thunderstorms. So I went around and I was in the Army and I was camping. Camping all the time, canoeing. And said, now make sure your tent's not under a tree limb that's going to fall down on you. And make sure that you've got your ropes tight and your pegs in. And they're working out, what does this guy know about this stuff? Some of them listened, a lot of them didn't. And it rained about 2.5 inches that night. And you could hear the thunder rolling down the river. I mean, I thought it was great. And somebody said, well, didn't you go around and check on people? I said, what's to check? I mean, I could hear some yelling. there's a lightning. Oh, my gosh. Everything flashing, a tree. The lightning struck a tree not too far away. And in the morning, I tell you, it looked like a bunch of gophers coming out of a gopher hole that had been water poured in it. I mean, what a great leveler. This woman who thought she was so up and coming. She looked just like the rest of us, soaking wet and our hair raining down. That, to me, is part of leadership training that goes way beyond the theory of it. And they told me after, a number of them did, that the experience like that was the best thing that ever happened to them. To learn the Mandan culture and then to experience what we experienced canoeing down the river. That was just one example. Another group we took to Central Alabama, and we lived with, I worked out Tuskegee, and Tuskegee helped organize this for me. And I hired a I hired a community development extension worker from Tuskegee University. And when I hired him, the university gave me all kinds of grief, the business office, because this stuff did not fit their model of what should be funded very well. Back to the mandats, one of the things we did one night was to have a buffalo roast. And I sent in a invoice, one buffalo, I don't know, $40, something like that. I don't think it ever hit the business office guy's desk before it was back on my desk. We do not fund buffalo purchases. I crossed off buffalo and put meat, $40. So I had lots of problems with that. Anyway, now we're in central Alabama, and this chap that I hired arranged for our people to live with African American families for a week, all across Alabama, Demopolis, Selma, all across. And we studied the civil rights movement. This guy had been a protester in this, a African American. When I hired him, the business office said, "You don't know much about this guy." I said, "What do you mean I don't know? He doesn't have a PhD degree." He said, "Well, he has a master's degree." "He should have a PhD degree if he's working with PhD people." I said, "Well, he doesn't." And they finally said, "Well, okay, you can hire him as long as he doesn't have a record, a prison record." I said, "But he does, because he was arrested several times protesting and sent to Vietnam because of his protest." That's some of the, they didn't know that. I didn't know that. There's a lot of history that's sort of hidden out there, dark history. And they got to know what it was like to be poor, poor black person in central Alabama. Not only by reading about it, in fact, not indeed reading about it, but smelling it, feeling it. So that's the kind of stuff that we did. We also, I organized a huge conference in La Jolla, California, for land-grant presidents. Biggest deal we ever pulled off. My gosh. We had college presidents, all they had to have extension programs, from all over the country in La Jolla for a, I don't know why, a three-day conference. I hired people from all over the place, and we're looking at what the future of outreach should be for universities. So anyway, I could go on at great length. I did special workshops for present day deans and directors in Stowe, Vermont. We went there in the off season. I rented an entire ski resort and we worked out of it. We set up rope courses across the river. If you screwed up, you fell in the river, and they learned something about leadership in that way.
Was this a fine, I mean, did you know when you came in that this grant was a finite, you were just going to do it for X number of years, and then you were.
Yeah.
So.
My money was to run out in 93. I had a little bit carry over into 94.
Okay.
Yep.
Was that, you earned emeritus status in 94. Was that?
Did what?
Emeritus.
Well, at that, now back to the department. I was supposed to be working half-time for Kellogg, and I was everywhere. I was doing workshops for cooperative extension administrators all over the country. I'd be in Arizona, Phoenix one day, and the next day I'm in Utah, and the next day I'm in California, and I was on the road all the time. So I wasn't here. I wasn't here very much. And we said it, Bob Ray was the chair then of the department. And Bob was a good friend, and we tried to organize this so I would have one semester I'd work full time on NELD, and another semester I'd teach my course, so that I'd try to get my time, and I still had my graduate students. So during those years is when I was not here to be involved. I so much wish I had been. Those were the discussions taking place of which departments now ought to be eliminated, especially in the College of Ag. And, well, by 98, the department was gone. And I could see that. One of the questions was, why did I retire at age 59? one part of me, I could never, ever replicate what I'd experienced those 3 years in teaching like I thought teaching ought to be done. There was no way I could replicate that without outside money, because it just does not fit the model for graduate education for it very well. I suspect today there may be a little more of that, but that kind of teaching and learning is so powerful. Oh my gosh, it goes way beyond. People say to me, "Well, how did you measure the results? For what kind of tests did you use?" Well, tell me how to create a test to tell whether or not people are learning anything from listening to a shaman talk about their creation story. So I packed it in the fall of 93. I did, for 2 years I worked part-time 20% because I had 8 or 10 PhD students that weren't finished, and I wanted them to get finished, so I helped several of them get finished. And I had always had, I told this to your colleague, I'd always had an interest in writing full time, and now I had that opportunity. People said, "Well, why in the world didn't you work toward becoming a dean?" I don't want to be a dean. I'm interested in ideas, not in administration. And I'm interested in writing about things. I'm interested in writing so people understand what I've got to say. My colleagues didn't understand that. In fact, the chair of the department at that time came to me and he said, "Jerry, why in the world are you leaving?" And I said, "Well, there are three reasons. I want some time to teach, I want some time to do research, and I want some time to write." He said, "That's what you're supposed to be doing here." I said, "Yeah, but you won't let me." I was on every goddamn committee that had ever been invented.
Jerry, I want to end this here because I want to sort of work through what we've done the last couple sessions and then make sure if there's some more questions I want to ask, we have sort of a final cap, maybe a shorter final capstone review. So unless there's anything on your mind that you would like to address before we wrap up today.
Well, it probably came through in some of my comments, but I feel very badly that our department was eliminated. And I don't know if I could have helped to prevent that. I don't know that. But it should not have been eliminated. The need for adult education, continuing education, remains as strong as ever. The number of VOAG teachers that are working today, the number is larger than ever. The demand for them is great. There are two schools, Platteville and River Falls, that are providing such training. But they don't have PhD programs, and not that that's necessarily important, but I think so. And so I feel badly about that. And it was so political, and with three deans involved, it's a model that the universities are not able to contend with yet. We talk a lot about interdisciplinary work, about collegiality, and it mostly is talk. We have not learned how to do that very well. There are some good hints at it. Follett to places like that. There's some good models, but we have a long way to go.
Well, Jerry, I want to thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.